away a blue cap.
Save going through it all yet again. We've got these five different aspects which unfold like the petals of a flower. No one can unfold fully without the others unfolding. They all work together. So we've got integration, positive emotion. So, spiritual death that Badra talked about last week, spiritual rebirth. And they're all, they all use the faculty of receptivity, which is what we'll explore next week. So today we're on spiritual rebirth. These two are about what's called shamatha, about creating the container in which we can unfold into insight, in which we can hold insight, which is really what these two are essentially about. And yeah, receptivity leads them all. So yeah, last week Badra talked about spiritual death, so the aspect of growth really, which is about letting go, about growing out of, moving away from things. And this week's focus is on, as we grow, what emerges when we do that. So they are, they're two aspects, you could say, of a natural process of growth. Anything that changes is changing from something into something else. And you can't make it happen. This is what I've always found intensely frustrating. You can't kind of, you know, just do spiritual death and rebirth in a way. We create the conditions through our practice of integration and positive emotion, partly, in which it can happen, in which it can arise. But you can cooperate with it. You can make it more likely to happen, and you can yield to it when it starts to happen. And actually, we practice with this process of change all the time, don't we? That's what we're doing. We're changing. So on our introductory course, quite early on, we set a homework to just do something different during the next week. It can be quite a trivial thing, but just do something that changes a habit and just see what that's like. And sometimes people do find that just making a change, I mean, people sometimes do quite big things that are really positive, but even quite little things can give you a sense of possibility. It sort of opens up a space where you've got a different choice, where you're not on autopilot. So this sense of this kind of spaciousness and freedom and creativity to do something different that arises when we don't do something we used to do. So that's the sort of spiritual rebirth flavour, the what emerges from that, the creativity, the spontaneity. A couple of weeks ago, people in the group I was in were talking about ethical changes they've made in their life. You know, perhaps becoming, eating less meat, things like that. And some people were saying they felt a lot lighter, a lot more aware, a lot sort of more open. A lot more positive in all sorts of ways. It was very inspiring to hear, actually. People made changes and they were sort of feeling the effect of that. We practice with it in meditation. We let go of one state of consciousness as another arises, and you move into something more creative, more delightful, more still. And in communication, Badra talked about this last week, how when you find yourself feeling a bit sort of up against it in communication, you can sort of soften into something. And actually, different possibilities arise out of that. And we practice with it through study. Just really engaging with the Dharma can change the way we see things, can change the way we view things. Most of my significant experiences actually have come from a combination of meditation and communication, sort of interweaved. So it's like I get softened up by meditation, so I'm more receptive. And then someone who I trust says something which strikes me as true, but completely contrary to how I've been viewing things. And it is very confusing. Badra evoked this very well last week, the way it's all, you know, it's an experience of like, hang on, how can that be like that? But then through meditation and reflection and further communication, I can sort of start to take on this other viewpoint. And usually it's an experience of great confidence and, yeah, freedom doing that. And often those things Because I think a lot of us have quite a lot of self-doubt or self-hatred, low self-esteem, whatever. Actually, those things that are really surprising and challenging about reality are often really quite positive and pleasant. So it's not like it's all sort of embracing nasty stuff. It can be things that I remember a time when I actually realised that my friends loved me. And it seemed like a really surprising and radical thing to kind of take on, that that could be a possibility. It was quite sort of, oh, really? But, you know, moving and, you know, and delightful as well. So as we keep practicing and keep changing in positive ways, and if we really reflect deeply on it, if we really keep noticing that's what's going on, eventually, or as we go along more and more, we see that, well, it's not just that we change, but that we are change. There's nothing other than this process of change happening. And at some point, this is like a really deep, decisive seeing, a really deep understanding of that. And from then on, it becomes easier and easier to release the old unhelpful ways of being and really allow new life to come through. And life becomes more and more sort of free and spontaneous and creative and meaningful, worthwhile feeling, more confident, more able to really engage with the process of practice. So how do we practice spiritual rebirth? So I think it's largely through developing faith, and that that allows our deepening commitment to practice, to our values, to the path, the process of embodying our values more and more. So I'll say a bit more about, well, I'll say a lot more about what faith is in Buddhism in a minute, but I just think it's really, really crucial to really dwell on faith, really develop faith. Life does give us opportunities for spiritual death. Badra talked last week about some of, you know, the way big life changes of bereavements or end of relationships or even falling in love can throw us into this state of not quite knowing who we are. But that doesn't mean that all those things that happen are a spiritual death. It's only a spiritual death if it leads to spiritual rebirth, if there's a sort of a positive change comes out of it. And those things happen to everybody, and not everybody makes a spiritual experience of it. A lot of people just pile more misery on the misery. It's very easy at the end of a relationship. I know this, my marriage ended a few years ago, and I could see the ways I wanted to, sort of tell myself things that meant about me, or things that I'd done wrong, or how, you know, what my worth might be, and I was quite able to not buy into most of those. But there were other things I'd find myself a bit unhappy and be going, oh, that's because I'm, you know, poor me, I've been abandoned. And I was like, no, I don't want to do that victim thing. And I just think, actually, I used to sometimes be unhappy before. It's not like being in that relationship was going to make me happy forever and always did. So it was a way of sort of bringing in more perspective, more reflection on it. So I think I was able to really make use of doing that because of her years of practice. I had a degree of integration and positive emotion. I had a lot of dharmic tools in my toolbox, and I had a lot of confidence in using them. And it's that confidence, another translation of faith is confidence, the word we translate. It's that confidence meeting suffering, which allows us from the gap. You remember on the Wheel of Life, there's that gap where change is possible, a different thing's possible than just going round again and again. What takes you out of that gap and up this augmentative process of positive change is when faith meets suffering. So it's really, really crucial in that point to bring in faith. So it is really important. While I was processing the ending of my marriage as well, the other thing I did was just really notice those little shoots of new life, the seeds of release in me, because although it was painful, there was a lot of sense of freedom opening up as well. There was lots of delight in that. So just to really allow those to be part of the picture was important. So faith, So the Buddhist Sanskrit word for it is shraddha. And as I said, that's sometimes also translated as confidence or trust, or confidence hyphen trust, which gives a bit of a different feel to us than faith, I think. Although faith is kind of stronger. Confidence is a little bit, So I quite like faith, but it has different sort of religious connotations for us, I think. We associate it often with a sort of blind belief, so it doesn't mean that in Buddhism. It's more a sort of total response of all of us to value and truth. It's a really natural human response. It's part of being human to respond to what's of value, to respond to values, to respond to qualities that are important. So everyone does that. You know, it might be more or less obscured in some people, but you know, you don't have to be a Buddhist to be moved by someone being kind. It's a human thing. And it's not a binary either or. It's not like something, it's not like I believe in God, I don't believe in God. It's not that kind of thing. It's something, it is a quality or a faculty that gradually grows and deepens as we practice. So it's not like you've got it or you haven't. You've all got a bit or you wouldn't be here, and it grows. And it's got three aspects to it, three strands. Three strands of Shraddha. So one part is rational, cognitive. One part is more intuitive and emotional. And then there's a bit that's about volition, about what we do and our experience. So it's really rooted in what we know from what we do and how that is for us. And they all weave together. They all sort of strengthen, feed each other, and all grow as they do that. So, for example, at some point, each of you has had the idea of learning something about Buddhism. Maybe you saw an advert, or you read something, or a friend said, why don't we go to the Buddhist centre? And something in you had an intuitive emotional response to that. It might have been quite faint, you might have missed it, but something in you had a yes, or you wouldn't have followed through. And then you did something about it. You came here. So you had an experience. And you might have checked it out rationally before you came. You might have researched a bit and read about it and thought, oh yeah, that makes sense, that sounds reasonable. But anyway, you came along. And then, yeah, so you had an experience of being here. And then as you did that, there was something you responded to again in a sort of intuitive, emotional, yes, kind of way. So that might have been the atmosphere as you walked in. It might have been the teachings you heard, something about the people you met. All kinds of different things might have kind of triggered you to kind of, yeah, drawn you to come back to do more. And you'd have thought about that, you'd have checked it out rationally. So you might have heard about the Metta Bhavana, and you might have thought about it and thought, yeah, that seems reasonable, that makes sense. You might have had an intuitive emotional response. You might have felt, that sounds wonderful, all that developing of the heart, all that loving kindness. I really want that. And you did something, you tried it, and you had an experience, which perhaps over time started to have effects on you. So you could then start to know through your own experience that it worked. And all aspects of what we do here are like that. You know, you hear about that everything changes, that happiness comes from the inside. You check that against your experience. Can I think of anything that doesn't change? Do the things that I've bought really make me happy? What is it that makes me happy? Oh yeah, it's a kind of contentment on the inside. So you check whether it actually fits with your experience of life. And then, yeah, if there are things to do around that, you start to try those, and that gives you further experience. And sometimes you just have a yes, that sounds true, kind of emotional response too, quite intuitive. So they all kind of happen and work together, and the further you go, the more of each of them happens in a way. And so it does involve all these aspects of ourselves. So it's like our whole being is involved in this response. And it's like a knowing of truth. It's like a way of really recognizing, really knowing in our being with all these sides of our being, how things are. It's like, yeah, things do change. Yeah, we know that. So we're recognising how things are, what's real in the world. It's like the concepts are a description of reality, description of how things are, and we can verify that. We respond to it and we can verify that for ourselves. So it happens, it's been happening, it's why we're all here, and this faith is something we can really pay attention to developing as well. So I'm going to talk particularly about developing the intuitive strand, because I think in our world, most of us are quite good at the kind of head stuff. We're kind of quite used to checking things out rationally. And, well, you just have to do things in order to have an experience. You have to be willing to give it a go. But I think the desire to do that is really fed by our emotions. It's like when our emotions are engaged, well, we follow that. We do that. So I'm going to talk mostly about developing the intuitive emotional strand. Because that's, I'm going to talk about learning what you value through doing that, about finding that in the three jewels, in the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha, and about dwelling on a sense of our potential, contemplating the profound. So yeah, how do we develop the emotional, intuitive strand of faith? I remember I thought I didn't really have this, but it's part, again, of our natural human response. But it's something that we don't necessarily value much or pay much attention to. So essentially, I think we just have to get into our hearts. I had to really get much more in tune with what was going on for me emotionally in order to notice where this faculty was operating. So I just recommend really paying attention to what moves you. It's as simple as that. So it might be people, their qualities, their ethical actions. It might be art, music, film, stories, myths, different things. You know, we all get moved by films sometimes, I'm sure. It might be being in nature. It might be meditation. There might be times when you're meditating, it's just like, oh, there's something about it that's a little bit, kind of, you can't quite find words, but you just feel moved. You don't quite know why or what that means or what it's about. It can be hearing the Dharma. There's this sort of yes response to truth, I think. We know truth when we hear it. And yeah, you can just sort of recognise it somehow. And it can be in symbols and myths and archetypes. So everyone so far in this series has talked a bit about those sorts of things. Taranita talked about the archetypes of our sort of sub-personalities, and Karunavarpi, talking about compassion, talked a little bit about Tara as a symbol of compassion. Badra was using those very vivid archetypes of beheading and salting and putrefaction last week, which, you know, they really sort of speak to us. But there's a way of really engaging with those around spiritual rebirth particularly. Yeah, I meant to say at the beginning of this talk, those images Badra used last week, they're from alchemy, and the point of alchemy is to create gold. So, you know, why would you want to do that? Why would you want to be beheaded if it weren't that you thought you were creating gold? And this talk is about the creating gold. It's about why we're doing this, what we're trying to create. So yeah, just noticing what moves you. I'm going to suggest you do that for homework this week, for your practice suggestion, that you just notice, just really clock when you feel opened or softened or moved by anything. Yeah, just pay attention to that. So doing that, it's important for noticing the faculty itself. There's this sort of movement of heart, which you can just learn to recognise. And it's important for learning what it is you value. So you can quietly and patiently start to explore when you're moved. Like, what is it about that that moves me? Why is it? What is the deeper resonance for me in that? And start to know that, you know, maybe kindness is important to you, or beauty, or truth, or whatever it is, wisdom, sort of, you can start to learn where your real values are for you. And the other reason I think it's really important to notice this response is because it lets you know those values are real and yours. So it lets you know that you're not doing this Buddhist stuff just to conform or be good or be a good Buddhist, because you know it's your heart response to what you're hearing, what you're doing. It's sort of, you can start to really recognise it as your own. Sangharakshita, our teacher, says that Shraddha is the resonance of the ultimate in us with the ultimate in the universe. So it's easy to look at, you know, the profound, the Buddha, whatever, and it to be a sort of very distant, big ideal that's way beyond us somehow and doesn't have much to do with us. But when you feel your heart's movement around that, if you can start to think that is a resonance of the ultimate in me, that's like the Buddha in me or the profound in me that's vibrating in tune with whatever I'm moved by, yeah, you can sort of really connect. So it's like a bridge as well between our highest ideals and our actual experience. Then if you're wanting to, you know, be a Buddhist or connect with that, it's helpful to start connecting all that with the three jewels. So it's really helpful to notice, for instance, if you do learn that kindness and compassion are things that move you, that's what's important to you, then, well, do you find that in the Dharma? Does the Dharma give you tools to become kinder, more compassionate? Does it work? When you try them, does it work? Are they the best ways you've found, the best things you've come across? Are they to be found in the Dharma? Do you find that resonance with kindness is triggered when you hear stories of the Buddha and how he behaved? Is he a sort of exemplar of the kindness that you want to find? So do you believe that he knew something about it in a way? Do you see that in the people in the Sangha? Do you see them being kind? And does the Sangha help you to practice the tools that produce kindness in you? So you sort of start to make links. Do you find whatever it is you're looking for in the three jewels? How much do they connect? How much do they hold those values? So this can take years and years of exploration and, you know, making different connections. It's really quite fascinating. And I do think it's really important to dwell on the gold that we're trying to create, to contemplate the profound. What we dwell upon, we become. That's the principle behind the Metta Bhavana. And so whatever qualities are important to you, dwell on them. But dwell on them in the ultimate sense. What could that be like way beyond your current experience? You can't really know that, but you can start to imagine and dwell with the things that bring it about for you. So if nature gives you experiences of relaxation and spaciousness and openness, then do that. Go and spend more time in nature. If you find being with positive people is sort of catching, infectious, you feel more uplifted and positive because you're with people who are cheerful and positive, have a good outlook, do that, spend time with them. But yeah, contemplate what could be born if you let go of all your limiting habits. What could you become? If you allow change to keep happening, what could that be like? In a way, you can extrapolate from your experience. You know, if practicing the Dharma has taken you this far, well, who knows? You didn't know a year ago where it would have got you today. Not exactly. What would that be like if it just went on and on, unfolding? When you notice something limiting you, particularly a limiting belief, we all have these views about ourselves and the world that kind of hold us, keep us small, really. Just ask, who would I be without this belief, without this view? I find that really effective sometimes, just to go, oh, well, if I weren't believing that, then everything would be so different. You know, I can usually sort of fill it in quite accurately, you know, well, who knows how accurately, but yeah, there's a real sense of like, oh, then that conversation would be easy if I wasn't thinking that that person didn't like me or whatever it is. It's, you can get an idea. But yeah, imagine enlightenment. Imagine being fully awake to reality. Imagine being a Buddha, imagine meeting a Buddha. What would that actually be like? I mean, we don't really know, but it really helps to just try and engage with that possibility. So this does move us again in this area of archetype. And as I was saying, I think that really engages us deeply. And I bet if you were here last week, the bit you remember is the bit about the salting and the beheading and the rotting and everything. It's the bit that stayed with me most when I listened to the talk. So it's important to really, yeah, dwell on the positive archetypes too. So the Buddha is obviously the sort of root version of that. You can look at the Buddha as an archetype. I think we've all spent time looking at this image and noticing what qualities it evokes for us. So it's an image of how we could be reborn, what spiritual rebirth might turn us into. This sort of still, fully present, very embodied, very human, serene presence, full of warmth and kindness, with this kind of cosmic otherness that's going on around his consciousness with all these bubbles around his head. But yeah, what does that mean? So I've brought along also the archetypal symbol that speaks to me most fully of spiritual death and rebirth and their inseparability, because actually you can't have one without the other. Spiritual death is only so if it gives rise to spiritual rebirth. Spiritual rebirth isn't possible without letting go of something old and limiting. So this figure that we've got on the shrine this evening is a Dakini. So she is a symbol of full enlightenment. She is a Buddha too, but a very different form. And although you can't see it in the statue, she is bright red. There's a little tiny picture you can come and look at later. And she's semi-wrathful. So she's actually a bit scary looking. Certainly from a distance, she looks pretty scary. She's fierce. She's determined. And spiritual death looks pretty scary to me. When I hear about all that beheading and that, part of me just recoils. It sort of doesn't, you know, it's not attractive. So yeah, she's fierce, she's decorated with bone. She wields this really sharp chopper. It's like a butcher's knife, which she uses to cut away all our wrong assumptions about things, all our limiting habits, all our ego clinging. But yeah, she's very much about rebirth too, because she's totally free. She's a sky dancer. She lives in the sky, so she's completely free to move anywhere through space in any direction, as you know, infinitely far as you can imagine. And as you get closer to her, you see that she's made of red light. And that's not so scary, because essentially she's made of love. She's made of metta. She's made of bliss. So that's actually, despite her, you know, scariness, it's very attractive, very appealing. She's naked, apart from these bits of bone she's decorated with, which speaks to me in many ways. She's naked because she's really intimate with experience. She's really closely in touch with what's going on. So she's like totally open and alive and aware of all the sensations, all the happenings, all the inner and outer sensations of her being. And she's naked because she's not defined by conventional forms of clothing. She's not fixed by those. Or she's not fixed by any habitual way of being. She's completely free to be anything. She can be a shapeshifter too. She takes different forms at different times. And she's naked because she's undefended. She's not hiding anything. She's completely open, completely who she is, completely fearless about that. She's got no sense of having to defend herself because there is no self to her. She really knows that. So there's no need to grip and grasp and cling on to old ways of being. She's just completely free to be what's appropriate in the moment. And she's dancing. She's got this constant movement. She never stops moving. She's a bit like a flickering flame or something. You can't just pin her down. You can't really see her. You can't really quite get her. She's very sort of elusive. Because she is. She's dancing with life. She's dancing with her experience, which is always changing. So she's always changing to meet it. Ever responsive, just ever creative, ever appropriate, spontaneously responsive to life. And yeah, she's made of love. She's like completely full of love, so that it's this blissful love is sort of bursting out of her, and it creates flames around her. So those are flames of love for all life, and they transform greed, hatred, ignorance, envy, pride. They're just always changing, all those things as they come up. And being so full of redness, of love, of passion for the Dharma, of truth, there's no need for her to be shaped by other people's opinions, expectations, judgments. It's like she's formed from within of the truth of love. She's completely fully herself, but completely receptive and yielding as well. Very open and responsive. So she's responsive, she's fluid, she's flexible, she kind of goes with things, but that doesn't mean she's wishy-washy in any way. She's also, you know, very much herself, very vivid, very red, very alive, very fierce. So it's a very sort of, yeah, I find it a very engaging picture of what we could become. And she's also a symbol of sangha, of spiritual friendship, of the real, real communication, which is the essence of spiritual friendship and of sangha. So she represents the sort of the real sparks between us that can happen, real sort of heart-based communication. And when we share inspiration, when we meet on that basis, something, you know, is ignited from one to another and fed in each of us. So she represents that too. She's got this sort of willingness to be seen completely naked, completely as who she is. And I think when we do that with each other, when we're really genuine, really honest about what's going on with us, this real close communication can happen. She's totally open, undefended, responsive. She's willing to change, willing to be visible. And she's just fully engaged in the dance of communication, the dance of sangha. Really there. I've been spending time recently with a friend who's been engaged in a particular process of exploration in herself, and I was really struck by how Dakini-like she's been in it. She's just been willing to step into the exhilaration of the unknown, to go into conversations which are challenging some of her views and habits and deep, deep patterns in herself, not knowing what the outcome will be, not knowing whether she'll get what she wants from it, willing to let go of what she wants, willing to kind of really touch the grief of that possibility and to really question what she's always assumed to be the way to be. Just sort of really giving herself to the process of it and trusting her friends, trusting the love of her friends who are questioning her and being open to that. And it was just really delightfully inspiring. It was irrelevant whether it was her stuff we were exploring rather than mine. It's just really lovely to engage with that with somebody. So I think true sangha happens in these moments of this sort of exquisite communication that can happen. They can just be moments, or they can be longer spells that I've just been having with this friend. But that's when we really touch sangha, when there's this real naked red meeting of each other beyond our our self-preoccupation, our old fixed ways. So we can inspire each other, we ignite our interest in something, exploring nakedly together. And in doing that, when we do that, when that happens amongst us, that's part of what helps the bodhicitta to come into being. So this suprapersonal energy towards enlightenment for the sake of all, the bodhicitta, it happens as we move forward together, as we inspire and help each other, as we really spark from each other through communication, through mutual influence, where we're just influencing each other into more and more close connection with the truth and more close connection with love, with metta. And in that way, as we all do that together, that's the way in which the Buddha land is always in the process of being built. So we're participating together in this dance of the darkenings, this dance of communication, as we build a Buddha land. And that's how we build a Buddha land. So our practice suggestions for the week, as I was saying, is to just notice what moves you. And you might write it down every day. It's really great to just keep a little journal and at some point each day to sit down and think, okay, what has it been today? So it might be really simple things. I was just watching a tree outside my window moving in the wind, and there was just something very delightful about that constant little movement. You know, what's that about? I don't know. But just write it down and then see if you can think, what is it about? Was it kindness? Was it truth? Was it beauty? Was it change? Was it movement? What? Anything that intrigues you, anything that opens you, just note it down. And probe patiently, gently, and see what it's speaking to in your depths. See if you can just feel that movement of heart. And even better, if in your groups you could find a buddy, if you pair up, you could agree to email each other about it every day. Then you've had a little connection into someone else's world. A friend and I had a whole project ongoing for weeks and weeks once, where any time we found something that seemed really significant or interesting to us, we put it in a shoebox. We had one each, and it was our myth box, and it was all about exploring myth and symbol. And so if I found a poem I loved, or if I found a picture that sort of seemed to speak to me about something, I put it in this box, and whenever we met up, we'd get out and sort of share what was in there. But today I'd just do it by email. It's a bit quicker, but it's a great thing to kind of get to know someone with. So that's your practice suggestion, your homework this week. Find somebody to email about what moves you, preferably every day. And in our groups this evening, our question is, well, it's not exactly a question, I'm going to invite you to talk about one quality that you find in the Buddha, the Dharma, or the Sangha, which you'd love to have more of, you'd love to be in touch with more of, you'd love to express more of in your life, express more fully. So just think of one thing, and there might be several, but choose one and just say a little bit about that, where you find it, what it means to you, and how it might be to have more of that in your life. So our groups, we're going to have our newish people who have recently come from the course on the sofas. Anyone who'd like a women's group is going downstairs. People who'd like to be in a men's group, stay in here. And people who'd like to be in a mixed group, other than the newcomers, will be in the front room.